I'm Larkin Kemp.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy. He is Larkin Kemp, and we talk about college lacrosse. Except this week, we are going to start by talking about professional hockey because it is a world with which Larkin is very familiar. And also, it is not every day that Wayne Gretzky's all-time career goals record is broken, and that's what Alexander Ovechkin just did literally 10 minutes ago. Larkin, I know you got thoughts on what this mark means. What do you got to say?
Just a remarkable accomplishment. Like, I think John Buccigross about a decade ago was the first media member who even like threw out into the incubator this concept, and everyone always landed on as Ovi aged, even though he's like a power play specialist and you can continuously feed him one timers. Like the notion of having 18 seasons averaging 50 goals as the league's gotten better, as the quality of the four lines and like the goaltending positions evolve, it's honestly just insanity. Like, it's a privilege to watch him play. It's a privilege to watch Sid do his thing. Like, Sid just locked up his 20th straight season of over a point per game. And I think a lot of people just kind of forget where we were post-lockout and, like, what those two have meant for the growth of the game and all these television deals. So I get, like, goosebumps when I watch those clips. Ovi is as cool of a dude as you'll ever meet. He puts, like, old school and professional sports. Like, he actually is taking rookies out for dinner, drinking the night before games. Like, he is what sports once were it with respect to like before dietitians and nutrition. And really what I mean by that is like, he makes memories. Like, he cares deeply about his guys. And, you know, every friend I've ever had who've played in that room couldn't speak higher of a guy whose English is his like fifth language. So just a really cool moment. I wish he was able to do it at home in front of his fans, but special day, and everyone should get out to watch him play while he's still going.
I don't have much to contribute. I live ostensibly in the market, and I've got a lot of friends that are Caps fans. And there's been a lot, you know, with the exception of the Ravens, there has been a lot of misery for sports fans in the DMV, and the Capitals and Ovechkin have been a shining star, standing out from the rest of that group for the last two decades.
Yeah, no doubt.
Notre Dame lost, so no surprise Nick Osello is not here. We are going to power through and see whether or not we can get him on for a five-minute stint. Call it a power play, if you want, at some point during this. But the slate was too incredible. The show goes on. Before we get in, I want to serve up a couple rants, and then we're going to talk about NCAA lax tickets, and then we're going to get into the action. Larkin, my first rant is about bracketology, and it's not really even about bracketology. It's about the willing ignorance. And, okay, let me frame it as a question, because I've been doing this for 15 years, and so as a result, I'm jaded and I'm tired of the casual fans' inability to understand that the poll is not the RPI. The RPI is not the poll. The poll doesn't matter. The RPI is what matters for the playoff criteria. Do I have too high of expectations for anonymous like user accounts on Twitter?
Short answer, yes, I think you do, but it also frustrates me. Like, I think, and this is more just like a blanket statement for fans, and I really hope that they push to understand this as they think about the imperfection that is the RPI, but like, ultimately, if Terry and his wife think about buying a house, what's the first thing you look at? You look at like what the other houses on the street have sold for, right? What are the comparables and the precedent? The unfortunate reality from what we've seen from committees is that they really do use RPI, especially for the seeding, like the 1 through 8, almost as the Bible. Like, there really have been very, very few processes that have kind of bucked that trend to the point where I just think of it as like the golden rule. So, yes, do I believe Ohio State at 11-1 is one of the hottest teams in lacrosse and deserves to be a top 8 seed right now? Of course. They're also currently 11th in the RPI. So, like, instead of yelling at us, the media members, about it, it's more just a wow. Like, it's kind of take it in, internalize it, and then do the mental model, the back envelope math of, okay, what does Ohio State need to do in the Big Ten tournament to get into the, let's call it top 6-7 in the RPI, where they realistically belong, right? Because I thought your first bracketology was spot on, irrelevant to where the bubble shook out and how angry people are about where teams are trending positive or negative.
So I want to build on that. by providing a little bit of historical context, I remember when Dave Yurick was the chair of the committee, I think it was 2011, and effectively, from the public's standpoint, what being the chair of the committee meant is that you were the lamb that was sent to pasture to try to defend what a group of people did in terms of interpreting a large set of data. You know what's really bad at interpreting large sets of data? The human brain. You know what's really good at it? Computers. And that's why they tend to be what gets utilized for these scenarios, but not in this system that the NCAA has chosen to adopt, which is injecting these five humans in between. It's basically a buffer between the data set and the output. And I've always used the term objectively subjective, because what the process allows for is you have these, you have this set of criteria, but they're not ordered, meaning that you can, it allows the committee to work backward from what they want the end point to be, and then you, and then they can figure out the justification by reordering the criteria in the way that yields that outcome. And what it really comes down to is the identity of the committee in terms of how strong they're willing to be imposing their own point of view on what the final bracket should be. And I would say the continuity is so important relative to understanding how it's going to operate. And I felt like when Jim Sadlisky was the chair, he took over for a woman named Heather Like, who at the time was an associate AD at Ohio State, then went on to become the AD at Eastern Michigan, then the AD at Pitt. And then Sadlisky was a associate commissioner at the Big East and then took a similar job at the American Athletic Conference. They were, one of those two was the chair for either a 3 or 4 year run from, call it 2016 to 18. There was a lot that happened, or maybe it was 15 to 17. There's a lot that happened in that window, specifically around the creation of new conferences that had broader impacts beyond just the seating and the selection of the tournament. They were the group that got the closest to trying to expand the bracket permanently to 20 teams before ultimately falling short, but they managed to get additional flights in certain years and really did a lot of good for building additional credibility within the NCAA, pushing it up the hierarchy of the way that they cared about championships and all that sort of thing. And then you had a couple of years where it felt like, I mean, candidly, I felt like Joe Amplo was probably the most important person on the committee. And I felt like, having, you know, spoken to him when the process was going on, the functional outcome of having a coach being the leading voice as opposed to an administrator was a larger emphasis put on, call it the eye test, but really it's the regional advisory committee, which is 15 coaches who meet with the committee members in order to share their perspective on quality that goes beyond just the numbers. Then we have a tournament that gets canceled in 2020. We have a 2021 season in which the RPI is irrelevant because since the Big Ten did not play, and neither did the MAC, non-conference opponents, you effectively had three leagues that you had to make choices within. There were some, you know, kind of hard and fast rules that were thrown out because they weren't able to be utilized in that scenario. And then in 2022, I think that's when you saw a little bit of, you know, the lack of continuity, the fact that there had been effectively 2 years where the criteria hadn't been applied and you couldn't infer what they were going to decide. And that's when, you know, Duke becomes the highest rated RPI team ever to miss the tournament at the seventh rank. And then Notre Dame obviously was a team that garnered a lot of attention for their exclusion as well. And I would say since then, right, you know, basically in the last 2 years, you've seen a little bit more adherence. The way that the RPI's use has been explained to me is that it is not in and of itself a criteria. It is the order by which teams are stacked up side by side, and that though effectively it puts you in a position where you're doing a lot of A/B testing, where you're comparing resumes against one another. And that's the way that I utilize it. So you know, I basically say, like, does this team's non-RPI criteria prompt it to jump up, right? And what's compelling about it is that there are times or instances in which if you to compare, you know, number 9 in the RPI from number 11, number 11 is actually more impressive. But when you insert number 10 in there in between, it's like, well, you know, on this basis, 9 and 10 are pretty close. 10 and 11 are pretty close. 11 doesn't jump 10. 10 doesn't jump 9. So even though if you look at 9 and 11 side by side, 11 would jump them, that's not how it works out. So rant over, talking about the RPI, and we have a new friend who gets to join us. Nick, welcome.
Am I welcome? Are you guys going to bully me, or are you going to show me the grace that I historically have shown you when something bad happens to your teams?
Well, to call it grace, we're going to reorder the lineup, and I'm quickly just going to say NCAA.com/laxtickets, aisle pod at checkout, $5 off. There's no better place. You're going to be there anyway. Do it, do it, do it. We'll hit you at the end. Nick, the Notre Dame Fighting Irish had a 7-game win streak against Syracuse. I believe the final scores in their prior 3 visits to the Carrier Dome / JMA Wireless Dome were 20-8, 18-11, and 18-11. They went in there, and they thought it was a game. Syracuse thought it was a damn fight, and they put Jake Taylor on his damn keister like 4 times in the first quarter. What'd you have to say about the way that the Orange took it to the Fighting Irish?
You know, I mean, if I were to look at the referees' geographic locations heading into the game, they probably were living in Gary Gates' basement, because the way that Jake Taylor was being treated is, I think, against the Geneva Conventions, the Paris Accord, and the Sokovian Accords. And some of those are fictional and some of those are real. It worries me that the way that Notre Dame has been successful the past 2 years has been being able to crack the code of any team that was put in front of them. And what I mean by that is leveraging athleticism, leveraging ball movement, leveraging good decision making. And it seems like an offense that has the script written for them. You know, completely shut down Jake Taylor and play as aggressive and physical as possible. And it's an offense that I don't have 100% confidence can play the type of game against a bruising defense to ultimately be successful. Now, what I want to hear from you two, I'm in a bad spot right now, guys. We've dropped 3. I was hoping to only have dropped 1 right now. I need you to talk me off the ledge, just like after Ohio State. How worried should I be? What were you guys seeing? Because I'm scared.
Larkin?
So I'm going to address the humanity of my friend Nick Osello and hope he doesn't drive off a cliff here. But I first want to give kudos to the game plan of both Pat Marsh and Gary Gate and Odie Erna on the back end. Like, to me, Notre Dame, founded in the Jerry Byrne cult identity, prides itself on not overthinking matchup integrity. And you can get Sean Light moving if you make him the primary slide decision maker, even if he wants to stay on Spallina. So I felt like Syracuse, we've complimented them all season. For 15-minute stretches, like, it truly looks like music. Like, they have 6 to 9 offensive players who absolutely rip the ball. It looks like professional lacrosse. You know, everything's on the ear. They're getting 4 to 5 shots of possession. They're aiming small, missing small. Like, there are moments where this thing looks brilliant, right? And I thought yesterday we combined both pieces of, like, we actually had a plan of attack. We weren't going to, like, primarily engage from X through 22. We were basically going to go top down, high wing, space it. We're going to get Light moving on the front side of the action. So if you just took a photo, right, like 4 of the 6 defenders now on the front side, and you know, you're going to get either a short stick or let's call it like a 3rd, 4th pole that's on the field, basically like spinning to a Leo or to whoever who can then go make a great decision. So like just blocking and tackling, that's a great plan. And it's a plan that more people should use, because ultimately Notre Dame is one of the very few teams that will take like a first team All-American quality athlete pull and not like get him through picks perpetually against a CJ Kirst or a Spallina or a Duffy or whoever it may be. So I felt like Syracuse's plan was really good. And now to flip sides of the ball, I actually want to highlight one particular player as like a vehicle to demonstrate to Syracuse faithful that I am watching. I'm not like totally cynical on your ball club. And I really do think they're like fundamentally improved. I think Michael Grace, 48, the close defenseman, who's like the D2, D3 transfer, who's super, obviously a really high-end player. Anytime someone who's not on like first-team All-American radar makes a Canadian national team, everyone's ears should perk up. Like, this kid in these circles that matter in Canadian youth lacrosse is clearly highly regarded, right? So, and when you just like isolate his play, he picks up tough ground balls. He allows, I think, Dwan to have a little bit of comfort in his like hedge spacing and not overthink things. And like, I think they really do have quality on both pipes. So I just thought their defense like out tough Notre Dame, candidly. Like I really do thought, I thought that, you know, they came for a gunfight, and that was demonstrated in their chunk and their slides, in the way in which they rode and cleared. So if you actually look at the stats, like I think Notre Dame left a few out there. I thought the refs, to Nick's credit, were, let's call it slightly one-sided. And, you know, does Notre Dame win that save battle if they play, you know, a seven-game series? Perhaps. But Notre Dame's still a very good team. I think it just represents that, like, Cuse is for real. They're trending. Cuse is certainly better in the dome, so that's the big question. But just based on eye test, it was a great day for Syracuse lacrosse, and good to have him back near the top of the mountain.
So if I'm evaluating concern, I'm probably just, you know, kind of three areas of the game, offense, defense, facing off. I think I'm probably most concerned about the defensive performance because saves were effectively equal. Notre Dame got 11, Syracuse got 10. Notre Dame got, you know, beaten badly at the faceoff X, but we've seen Will Lynch win this matchup last year. And obviously there's enough of a track record, and it's so matchup dependent that on a day-to-day, game-to-game basis, I'm not going to overreact to that. Offensively, they only scored 9 goals. You feel like you're going to need more than that in order to win in the dome. But what's crazy is, so you win 9 faceoffs and you clear the ball 16 times. That's 25 possessions. I mean, 9 goals on 25 possessions, that's almost 40%. That's a good day. It's not 25 possessions because, and this is probably the most amazing stat, Syracuse failed 9 clears. Notre Dame rode the ball back 9 times. And again, you can kind of look at that both ways and say, holy shit, we rode the ball back 9 times. That's a great day. But if you're not converting those into goals, then obviously, to your point, Larkin, you're leaving a lot out on the field. What's crazy about this is, you know, you hear, oh, it kind of felt like a tale of two games, tale of two halves, or, you know, this felt like 3 or 4 games jammed into one, because the first 5 minutes, when Devin McClain's, like, just precision and fluency around the crease was so impressive and validating what I think we all had kind of felt like had been the most important choice that Notre Dame had made as a staff this season, which was to go with him as the second attackman. And the way that their offense in the early going looked so coherent with 2 guys behind and 4 up top, and the amount of action where they had off-ball cutters flowing to the ball carrier's face for a throw-ahead pass, basically like 2 guys like circling like this toward each other that yielded an open look. It to your point, Larkin, about Syracuse's offense looking like music, that was the way I felt about Notre Dame's offense early on. And obviously it went dormant. They didn't score for almost 40 minutes, or maybe a shade over 40 minutes. And then once they started scoring again, it felt like it was a winnable game. I mean, they cut it to 9-6 and 10-7 in the beginning of the fourth quarter, and ultimately Syracuse responded. And last week when Syracuse beat Virginia, we talked about it as being a resilience game, a game in which they showed that they had learned how to win. And I feel the exact same way about this one. To fail 9 clears and figure out how to win, impressive. To basically hold your opponent scoreless for 40 minutes, not pull away to the point where once they string a couple goals together in the third quarter, the game's now back in reach, and then to score 4 out of 5 or 3 out of 4, whatever it was, in order to put the game away, that is learning how to win. And I think this team, which is still, I mean, they're juniors, right? They're still not seniors. To have demonstrated that amount of learning how to win was impressive. So, Nick, does that make you feel any better?
No.
Okay, good. I wasn't really trying, because you're dodging the podcast after you lose.
Yeah, well, first off, no, I'm not. Larkin, I'm going to turn my phone around. Mile High Stadium, right behind those, that's where we met, and that's where we became brothers. So let's keep that in mind as I ask this next question. There was a lot of banter and going back and forth in our group chat this week, and there are 2 things that I want to be discussed publicly, and that's, who are each of you voting right now putting at the number one spot in the country?
It's still Cornell.
Still Cornell? Larkin, you were kind of making a case for Syracuse, and I wanted to give you a chance to elaborate that, because I think it's a compelling one.
Well, I'm going to articulate it in long form prose, but I basically think there's now like two lists. The first is like, who is the number one team in the country based on, let's call it like the full season of data. And I think that's unequivocally Cornell. Like their one loss is to Penn State at home in a game they probably should have won if not for that penalty. But based on the film yesterday of Cornell at Brown and the reality of like, I think Cornell is a okay to good roster that happens to have a generational lefty at attack. And that set of input variables, like historically to win four really hard games in May, right? Like Rob Pinnell couldn't get it done at Cornell. There's so many examples, Lyle at Albany, all these different examples of like CJ Kirst is elite. I don't know if the Cornell poles are. I don't know if their short stick D mids are. So I think it does set up this like second ranking, which is a little bit more of, and this is the hockey player in me, where it doesn't really matter, you know, who wins the President's Trophy in the regular season. Like, who is hot right now? The St. Louis Blues have won 12 games in a row, right? Like, that type of input, basically information and eye test. And I think there are a few groups that are, like, fundamentally trending, right? Out of, let's call it, this massive block of top 12 in RPI. Because most years, let's use, like, 22 Maryland or something as an example, right? There's a lot of really fun stories, like, down the RPI table. But most years, there's like one or two groups that honestly are just like elite and better. Notre Dame last year being a great example, or the year prior. And this year, I think for the first time in a while, it's like actually wide open. And a lot of it will come down to like seedings, matchups, health of the attack unit in May. So like, I think Cuse, you could easily make an argument, and like maybe UNC based on that film yesterday, or whichever group you want to pick, with Maryland losing, Ohio State's obviously trending. So maybe like Ohio State, Cuse, and the Heels are like hot right now, right? And if we were just gambling the way we will gamble on the Masters this weekend, right? Scotty hasn't like had the best start to his season. He's still the odds-on favorite, right? Like, so there's a little bit of that, which is
that outside. Makes him Notre Dame in this analogy?
Yeah, that probably makes him, I would say, yeah. Like the Notre Dame is the example of like past major champion who's like not hitting greens. He's missing fairways through the first 8 weeks of the professional season. But like ultimately, I'm taking a flyer on him as the 6, 7, 8 seed. Because if they get out of the first round, like if Notre Dame is the quote unquote like statistical underdog at North Carolina in the quarterfinals, like is anybody not taking Notre Dame? Just as an example. So like, and I think there'll be a lot of examples like that. So and candidly, I think that that's what makes this podcast today, and more importantly, what the events of yesterday with Maryland losing, like the RPI is chaos. It's absolute chaos as a ladder, because my prediction is that Princeton will lose to Cornell in the Ivy tournament. So like what that'll do to kind of just the math at hand and the seeding implications and like all of it. It's just really exciting to be a fan. And I think for the first time in a while, like a Harvard Crimson fan wakes up today, like dreaming of a top four seed and like an actual path to the Final Four, right? That's pretty wild. Like, I think Harvard's pretty good, I guess, but like not elite by any stretch. So that's, I think, exciting as a fan.
Nick, final thought, and then you can let us get back to the podcast.
First off, again, I will address the listeners that tune in to this podcast every week to hear me. I'm sorry I can't join in the full length, but sometimes work and duty calls. And to Larkin's point, there are two wolves fighting within me. The Notre Dame wolf that was able to just speak very loosely last year, knowing that we had the best top to bottom roster, and essentially knowing that once we started beating Duke and Virginia in the ACC tournament, or at the end of the year last year, that we were essentially going to tap dance our way to a natty. That's fun. Some folks might call BS on what I'm about to say. I do think it's more fun, to Larkin's point, that 15 fan bases have woken up this morning and gone, we have a real path here. Like, there's a way in which we could sneak in. No team is bulletproof. There's no team, even Cornell, to the extent that they're having a great season. Even them, there's not a team that you're looking to truly avoid in the playoffs, because every team has shown cracks. And so from a fan and from a lacrosse perspective, I love how this season is going. I hate that Notre Dame's dropped three. And, you know, yes, I did load up my diaper when I was checking the scores and I was shitting my britches a little bit. But at the same time, that guy in the back of my head who's going, what a great thing for lacrosse. So many fan bases are engaged. Maybe it put your, maybe it elevated your humility a little bit. Maybe it was, maybe that was the time to have it happen. And I'm excited. I love this country. I love Notre Dame. I love this sport. I love you both. I love what I do for work. And it's a great day in America, fellas. Ocello out. What a pathetic. Well done.
One more note on this game. It was played in front of a crowd of 11,268 fans, which is the biggest crowd of the season so far, biggest crowd in the Dome since 2015. I didn't think we were going to get a number that big, and the Cuse people that I was speaking to suggest that they think we're going to get an even bigger crowd for Carolina, so that would be incredible.
Wow. Incredible is right. That's a big boy number. And challenge to the Cuse faithful. Let's break 15.
There you go. So, as mentioned, we are recording on Sunday afternoon. We just saw Penn State pull off a 11-8 come-from-behind victory in Ann Arbor to claim their first Big Ten win of the season and knock Michigan from the ranks of unbeaten within that conference. This was a game in which the Nittany Lions went into the fourth quarter trailing 7-6 and reeled off five straight goals as Jack Ferrassian settled in. He had been he'd been a little bit shaky in his prior two games and was certainly excellent on the day, but particularly so in the fourth quarter, finishing with nine saves. Matt Traynor led the way, led the scoring for Nittany Lions with three goals and an assist, and Ethan Long had a goal and two assists. Liam Matthews finished with two, and he had a goal that I would call the icer, where he had this incredible kind of look away head fake that kind of froze Hunter Taylor and allowed him to finish. I think that for as well as Frassian played it, you also got to give a fair amount of credit to the Penn State defense, particularly how they settled in to their zone. I thought this was a game that kind of illustrated the kind of dual nature of zone, right? Where like on the first hand, you tend to employ it because you want to throw a changeup to your opponent. And then on the second hand, you know, it also potentially covers up some of the deficiencies. And certainly early on, I felt like Michigan was finding a lot of success dodging Penn State's shorties. And, you know, they kind of that really took that tool away in terms of generating space and open looks. And then, you know, just to kind of give Penn State's shorties a little bit of flowers, Brennan Leary, at this point, I don't think it was necessarily the icer. I think the game was pretty well in hand, but the punctuation mark was a half field goal against the 10-man to get, I believe, his first goal of the season. He's wearing Grant Hawes' number two and is, you know, one of Penn State's top short 50 middies. So I felt like the zone really stabilized that spot on the field in that matchup. Larkin, who do you think this game matters more for? Penn State to avoid going to 0-3 in the Big Ten, or to Michigan from the standpoint of, you know, a little bit more disruptive after they'd been kind of smooth sailing with wins over Hawkins and Maryland?
I think in a vacuum, the needle points Penn State with respect to the 0-3, but I think because this drops Michigan to 6-5, right, with Rutgers and Ohio State left, I think it does introduce the complexity of, like, they need to be tournament eligible, obviously, unless they run the table like they have the past 2 years. So I think it just disrupts a lot of the momentum. And I think that, like, what the Big Ten's become, right, is that it really is like a week in, week out. Any team can win. You kind of take the under in these games. They're all basically like 10-8 late, right? Think about, you know, Maryland Rutgers yesterday or Hop Ohio State. Like, they really do represent kind of like college basketball style chess matches of, you know, 6v6. There aren't that many penalties. Like, it's the clearing and the riding's efficient. No one's beating themselves is the term I'd use. And I was not shocked by the outcome today. I think Penn State, which I've doubled down multiple times on this podcast, has really had some bad luck injury bug. And let's call it like in-season adversity that's potentially disrupted their ceiling. So to Kevin Connery's credit in Michigan, like, whereas maybe they did hit theirs for a month, like I'm not sure we've seen the true upside case yet in Penn State. So I took them to win this game, but like ultimately these are two good teams. What this does introduce obviously is like Michigan, and this was talked about often this week when you released the bracketology, but with this loss, Michigan drops to 13 in the RPI. So that is truly like a representation of what I would call the bubble. So for all, you know, Michigan faithful, make the effort, obviously, to get out in person this week. They're at Rutgers, and that's a game, you know, you more or less have to win unless you're taking the back door out of, like, we're just going to run the tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I probably would have gotten there, but of the timing of Nick joining, yeah, I mean, I think that one of the – so the exercise of bracketology, because one of the other criticisms that I got that is more valid is, like, the data is undercooked. To do this now doesn't have value, and I disagree with that because I think that the undercooked data is actually a really useful leading indicator that helps – effectively avoid jumping into a super cold swimming pool or a pot of boiling water, right? Like, you know, at this stage, yeah, it is undercooked relative to what it's going to be in 31 days, but we still have more than 66 and probably more than 70% of the data points that are going to end up informing this final result. And the data points that are available are going to be compounding in nature, which, as long as you understand what the trends are that has led to this point, then you can start to build in the compounding nature of the data in ways that can be become super useful in terms of informing your you know, kind of suppositions or whatever. And the thing that I took away more strongly than anything else is that, you know, it really does feel like that there is a pretty solid top four. It's not to say that it's impenetrable from any of the teams 5 through, call it 8, maybe 9, but probably just 5, 6, 7. One of those is Harvard. I do anticipate that they're going to slip into that 8, 9, 10 range. But probably the most important takeaway that feels the most durable is that it is unlikely that anybody that wasn't in the bubble mix, and for me, the bubble this week was Ohio State, Michigan, Duke, was going to catch them from behind. Richmond is the most viable competitor. Richmond is also the likely, you know, the presumptive A-10 winner. And if they don't win the A-10, while they will have a very strong RPI, they won't have the other elements of their resume that I think are going to knock one of these contending teams off of the bubble. So the interpretation that I had on Thursday was, I think Duke has, if you're looking at Duke, Michigan, Ohio State for three spots, or I'm sorry, for two spots, Duke has to get in because they beat Michigan. So either, you know, so regardless, Michigan and Ohio State cannot get in without Duke getting in over the Wolverines. And then when you look at the Wolverines and Ohio State's resume side by side, it is almost impossible to compare because they're diametrically opposed. One has a great record, more quality wins. They have the same number of top five wins, which to me has always been a trump card, but they have a bad loss. Whereas Michigan has a worse record, a better RPI, no bad loss, one fewer quality win. Like those two resumes are hard to contrast against one another. And typically, like, you don't end up evaluating resumes that are that different from each other. So that's just the summary statement on where we're at from an RPI standpoint. And I think that your point's well taken in terms of, yeah, don't forget, like, Michigan's going to have to figure out a way in order to be above 500, in order to be at-large eligible. You know, they might have a good resume and finish below 500, depending on how the number of games that they have left to play shakes out. So that's a good call out. For me, it is like I shade Penn State, but that probably is because I saw them in person last week and I just came away really unimpressed. Not by their overall quality, but just by their energy. And I think that if you'd watched the first three quarters of today's game, you would have come away with a similar type of impression. So it really comes down to how much your season can pivot in a 15-minute window. And I think that, you know, if you're a parent listening to this and you're talking to your kid who just had a bad game, one of the sources of encouragement needs to be, you don't know kind of the thief in the night, right? Like, you don't know when the opportunity is going to arise, and it's going to be very narrow. It's going to be very marginal, and it's going to be very significant. So that's why you have to stay vigilant. That's why you have to stay ready. So with that being said, let's talk about the Ivy League. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start in Philadelphia? Do you want to start in Providence? I guess we could quickly get through what happened in Hanover.
Yeah, yeah. I think Hanover makes sense. So, yeah, let's start there. So, basically, and I want to cushion this. Like, everyone knows my bias towards Sean. Like, ultimately, I am not shocked by this outcome. Like, I think he's done an incredible job getting a ton out of a roster that still has, like, a talent gap between the rest of the league, right? And ultimately, getting that group to 7-1 and going to Franklin Field and winning deserves, like, all of the flowers that that group got. And I'm really happy that there was a week where the national narrative was like, oh my goodness, is Dartmouth, like, making a push for...
And to be fair, they followed it up with a good performance against Princeton, even though they lost.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think he was very unhappy as an offensive guy, an offensive efficiency person, right? A former coordinator. He was just unhappy with the turnover margin, let's call it, in the Princeton game. So he felt like that game was gettable. And on film, it was. Unclear whether Madelon would agree that Princeton played well. I think where I was nervous for them is there's this, like, kind of... There's this consistency challenge of when you start to play better teams late, when you open the season with a month of... you know, cupcakes is the wrong term, but, like, let's call it 30 to 70 in the RPI, right? You get used
teams
to...
that you're supposed to beat.
Correct. And Sam King and Harvard come to town, coming off of, you know, a restful week beating Binghamton at home and having played, you know, five teams in the top 10 or whatever it is this year and being battle tested and him being a fourth year senior who's, you know, been the primary ex Dodger forever, right? It's like, it wasn't a great set of input variables, let's call it, for a Dartmouth upset. I did think that the product would be closer. So I think this is like a flower in the cap of Harvard, just with respect to like doing their job, like getting on the bus as 2.5 goal favorites and like, you know, beating the pulp out of a team you should. Not easy to do in league play, especially the Ivy, by the way. Ivy historically has always been, you know, a league where, you know, the top three seeds like only go 3-3, like, or 4-2. Like, it's not a league where teams blow people out. No different than the Big Ten or, you know, Patriot or whatever league you want to use as a case study. So I was a little bit surprised, but I think this is ultimately a representation of where the league sits. So we really do have like two teams at the top, in my opinion, with Cornell, Princeton. They will battle for the home field advantage, more or less. Cornell realistically already having a one, so they're going to host in Ithaca. Princeton should be the two seed. They beat, obviously, Harvard. And Harvard will be the three. Now is where we can basically transition to optimize time here. Unlike most years where the fourth seed in the Ivy is actually going to a team that's like truly on the tournament bubble from an at-large perspective, 22 being the best example, like Yale and Penn and Brown, unfortunately, and of course Dartmouth, are a pretty large gap below, I'd say, and trending in different directions. So I think what we saw at Franklin Field was two groups really heading in opposite directions. I'm not sure Murph and the Penn group has looked so lost on film in the last 5+ years. They are, imploding is the wrong term, but after an uninspired effort at Cornell where they went down like 7-1 in that game, 10-2, whatever it was, like truly got their head kicked in Ithaca, which is not, like, just to be clear and to challenge that group, the senior leadership in particular, like they have a cover guy in 41 Laval, who should be able to neutralize Kirst or at least limit his productivity the way Charlie Cave did for Brown yesterday, that makes that game more of a rock fight. Like, Cornell should not blow out Penn this year. But they did. So that's a question mark. And now going home, and you've got a 2-5 Yale team that in the first half against Brown, like, if you just cut the film, Yale's D gave up a ton. Like, Brown did not shoot well. We easily could have been up 4-1, 5-2 after that first quarter. I'm sure if we got Torpy out after a few beers, he would fully admit that he thinks he could have stole that game. I do too. I was literally there. And we all know where Brown is on the rebuild trajectory. So, like, I'm not trying to overstate their quality. So to me, it's like Yale and Penn are pretty mediocre. But Yale, you know, really did, kick their head into a degree, and I'm not surprised. And Yale is, Sean obviously hopes and thinks Dartmouth can beat Yale. I think Yale is realistically trending towards being like a huge thorn as the four seed and a team that Cornell probably doesn't want, because remember, they're going to be a huge RPI problem. God forbid you lose that semifinal game, which Andy Shea has a ton of precedent for. Like, he's always been a good Ivy League tournament coach. Like, that is not good for Cornell's hosting and kind of where they fall in the map. So I'll pause there.
and let you respond, and then we can go to Brown Cornell.
Yeah, so a couple things. Just back to Harvard, jump out to a 9-0 lead. Jack Spiedel scored the first three goals and finished with 6-1. And I just think that it's worth mentioning because, to your point, I mean, this has been a team where you could kind of – I don't know why this is the analogy that popped in my mind, but you know how, like, most countries in the world, you know one city in the country, right? And so for all intents and purposes, like, the city is the country, right? Like, when you visit that place or whatever – you could kind of swap Harvard for Sam King. Like, they are one and the same in the conception of the way that most people think about them. And obviously, Teddy Malone has been, you know, a important contributor for the last 2 years. But I think the continued emergence of guys who share the production burden goes a long way, especially for a player like King to kind of live out what is his destiny in the highest leverage games, which is being the end of shot clock goal creator. If you can put him in a position where that is as much the only thing that you ask of him as possible, like, to me, that is how you win Ivy League tournament games and first round NCAA tournament games when you're the underdog in an 8-9-7-10 type matchup. So I think the emergence of, you know, 3-4 other guys who can reliably put in 2 to 4 points per game is the sustainable way to, you know, the 14-11 win on the road at whatever. Ohio State is what comes to mind first. I'm not sure that that's the draw that they're going to get, but let's just say it is. Like, that's, you know, that I think that's like a realistic thing. Specifically when it comes to Penn Yale, it's funny because you have aptly made the point a couple times that Penn does not blow teams out because they are so defensively oriented. And I felt like that was why this was a bad matchup for Penn, because what Yale gives other teams, Penn is less equipped to take advantage of. What's interesting is, you know, they had so much of their scoring production in the hands of two guys. Griffin Skane went for 5 goals and Tynan Walsh went for 1-4. What Yale's defense is so susceptible to are your second line midfielders ending up completely naked on the backside for the best shot they've had in a game in 3 weeks. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, like, you know, this guy who basically wasn't on the scouting report has 3 goals in the second quarter and it's completely changed the complexion of things. And for whatever reason, that's just not who Penn is. I came away really, I reacted strongly to Chris Lyons. The simplicity of his post-game comments, and, you know, I've made this comment a few times, but shout out to the groups that decide to do a little bit more when it comes to their web streams. Boston U has sideline reporter. Penn has a sideline reporter. Like, we appreciate the work. It is, even if it's only a minute or 90 seconds, getting to hear from a coach or a player post-game, at halftime, whatever, it all has value, and I just want to make sure that it's known it's appreciated. But what Lyons said was, we just have to win. We just have to win. He just said the same thing like 6 times. And more than that, he said, we know we are not going to get an at-large bid, which means that the only thing that matters is that we just have to win. Get this. Yale's RPI is going to skyrocket. My forecast is that if they finish the regular season 6-6, so basically they win the next 4 games, which they will probably be favored in almost certainly, and then lose to Princeton, they will be number 15 in the RPI, which is not a team necessarily that you want to lose to in the Ivy League semis. In the forecast that I just put together, Cornell is number 1 in RPI and Princeton is number 2. So in that scenario in which it's a Cornell 1 seed, Yale 4 seed in the Ivy League tournament, you know, Cornell probably drops to 3, right? Which is a big difference. The difference between playing a play-in game winner and not is an enormous difference, because you're playing on a team on 3 days rest or a team on a week's rest. That's a big difference. Probably not in terms of whether or not you win or lose, but certainly in terms of how likely it is that you're going to have your starters on the field in the third and fourth quarter. And that's the type of thing that then has an effect in the quarterfinals. So with all that being said, yeah, I mean, I don't have a prescription for what's going on with the Quakers. I do have a question for you, and it may seem like a little bit of an odd place to bring up, but there has been so much focus, and I have contributed to this as much as anybody else, so I'm not trying to externalize this. But the focus has been on how this is the first post-COVID year, And in most ways it is. But for some teams, Cornell and Penn specifically have a ton of fifth and sixth year guys. Maryland and Duke have a lot of fifth and sixth year guys. Ohio State a little bit, but maybe not so much. Like, I, for 3 years, have talked about how the additional grade has been a challenge for Loyola to manage. And I just used it as an example because it was very acute. And I was pretty familiar with kind of the internal dynamics such that I knew that it was contributing to it. It's clearly not a hindrance for Cornell, but maybe it is for Penn. I'm just asking you to indulge the thought exercise of if it is, why, and if it isn't, how.
And just to add an additional layer of complexity, I think unlike most leagues, like the Ivy League, it's by school and it's like based on the relationship
totally.
Between the athletic department and the dean of students. And also on an incremental level, it's whether they have like a graduate program that like fits. So AKA, do they have like a master's of, you know, business or whatever it is? I think that makes a ton of sense. I think it has to do with the relationship between like the sixth, fifth year offensive seniors and like whether they gel with the new quarterback of the team, if that's not them, or, you know, the anointed captain of the next class. And remember, like in the Ivy League, you do not get the same amount of hours with the men in the fall. And if those guys have not, they're intentionally not taking classes and they're like off campus doing an internship in New York, or they're working, you know, a 9-to-5 to make money as they should, right? Like, it becomes a challenge to re-inject them on January 22nd or whatever it is when you open practice and you have a really important game. If you're, I mean, Yale opened with like four really challenging matchups, right? And you have you know, 3-4 weeks if you're Penn to re-spin those players up on not only your culture, but more importantly, like how has the dynamics of both sides of the ball changed? And like, yeah, that can certainly lead to roadblocks. And you could have part of the room that's like already mentally checked out and another part of the room that's fully bought in. And like, ultimately there's a ton of talent in Penn's room. So the same way, like I've felt comfortable calling out, you know, the Michigans and the Hopkins, like Murph has, you know, top 10, top 15 classes every year. He's got guys like Leo Hoffman who are top 5 recruits, right? Like, ultimately, the production hasn't been there on that side of the ball. And, like, every question needs to be asked, inclusive of, is it time to move on from the fifth and sixth years? But, yeah, I think the question's fair. And, like, it does make it really, really hard to kind of truly call out this line in the sand and make it binary of the end of this COVID era, right? Because you have this, like, never-ending cascading waterfall of implications where guys are on the front end of college, like, taking PG years or, like, slowing down their high school because they want like Schellenberger to graduate.
Opportunity, yeah.
Right. So it's this very challenging thing to map. And I think, you know, calling out Penn and Cornell as like an A-B test is a really interesting case study in a group that clearly is trending on it versus potentially not.
So let's talk about the importance of chemistry and buy-in and being super aggressive when it comes to an experimental tactic. So dating back to his High Point days, John Torpy would have the scout team scrimmage the starters, and whoever won got to start. And I talked to him about it as an exercise. And I remember him saying, you know, there were some moments where we thought the scout was going to win, and then Asher did something crazy, or, you know, Jack Van Overbeek did something crazy, and the starters won, right? They kind of proved why they were the starters, and it never came to fruition. Well, That strategy came home to roost, and it did so against the number one team in the country. And boy, howdy, wow. Larkin, your thoughts?
I mean, it's a loaded question. Let me start with something positive, and then I'll get to the scout team nuance. I thought John had a great plan yesterday. Like, I do not have the relationship with Torp because I didn't play for him that I did with, obviously, Dales or Lars, so I can't speak to the nuances of his prep. I know he's a grinder. I know people think very highly of him across the game. Like, he had a great plan yesterday. I thought both coordinators showed up in a big way, and, like, ultimately we got a lot out of our room, which is what I look for as a fan, and I want to see the program trend, and I want recruits, when they turn on the film against a team like Cornell, to see that we are making a commitment to, like, be elite at lacrosse or Brown. So I tip my cap. My only complaint, actually, with the scout team thing is, if you're going to do it, and the scouts win, you got to play them for more than just a possession. Like, I actually think if you're going to put your credibility on the line with that, like, you do have to give the boys some run. But I think it should be a call out to everyone listening. Like, there are so many quality guys up and down these lineups, not just at Brown, but at every roster. I mean, imagine an ACC roster on any given day. All right, let's use a very specific example. When we were preparing for the 2020 Worlds in Israel, the quote-unquote scout team, the guys who got cut the next day for Team USA, literally beat the wheels off of the team in Florida that went to Israel and beat Canada in the gold medal game. Like, we won that game, I think, like 16-8. So it's just it's a representation of, like, there's so much depth, there's so much quality. The margin between being, like, the third offensive midfielder and the ninth is just tiny at this level. So it's not shocking, and I think that when you think about, like, buttons to press, when you're a team that's obviously getting beat up, you know, not just this year, but last year we struggled as well. So it's a team that's unfortunately done a lot of losing. And, like, I want to remind them that we have a championship culture. And, like, there's a reason there's banners on the wall that you walk by every day and a Torreton in the hallway. Like, it we're never that far away. And, like, it takes all 45 guys. So
let me jump in there, because to me that is the point. And I'm not going to disagree with your notion of you have to play more than a possession, but I think I just want to reiterate what my internalization of the goal of the exercise is, which is not necessarily to say if you win, you are rewarded. More so, it goes back to the point that I said earlier, which is about remaining vigilant. If the margin between the ninth and the third best midi is as narrow as you say, and I agree that it is that narrow, then what matters is the ninth midfielder's level of effort on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in order to get the best out of the third midfielder in two ways and for two reasons. Number one, because they're competing against each other, and the third midfielder needs to compete and be better than somebody that he is starting over, right? Like, that is something that comes internally. And then the second element is the notion that that player knows that if the ninth midfielder is outperforming me, I will lose my spot. But if the ninth player is not trying hard enough because he doesn't believe that there's an actual pathway toward getting there, then neither of those outcomes are going to be yielded. And so I think that this is a very, like, kind of blunt way to demonstrate that more broadly. And, you know, you can argue, like, that bluntness is the flaw in the idea, or in the plan, right? Especially when you're contrasting a strategy that works at High Point and with High Point kids to a strategy that may or may not be as effective and work in the same way that you would want it to with Ivy League kids. Totally open to that conversation. But I think that the way that I interpret the value, again, just to say it a second time, is it's about creating the expectation and the reason for guys 28 through 30, 45 on the roster to show up and compete as hard as you need them to in order to make sure that 1 through 27 are getting the test that they need to in order to be their best on Saturday.
Yeah, I think that's really, really well said. And just to give one other vehicle as an example of how coaches do this, Lars at all times has a whiteboard with 1 through 45 players' names by position. My junior season after the fall, and I just for reference for people who obviously didn't watch me play, I was a second team All-American as a sophomore. I was the fifth defenseman and not even the starting LSM at the end of the fall as a junior. Like, there's a level of accountability when there's a whiteboard and you walk in for your...
Who was ahead of you?
I mean, Tullett was for sure, but the other two guys, I think I'm way better than.
I know. That's why we want to know who was ahead of you.
But it's a representation of, like, think about the accountability when I went home from break after that meeting, and I obviously believe in myself, but, like, you can envision I hit the gym, I pounded pavement, like, I got in the car with my sneakers and I made my dad drive me 10 miles away from Montgomery Lane to fucking run home in the rain. Sorry for swearing. So, like, this is just another example of, like, you gotta get lift out of the bottom of your roster. And every coaching staff has a different way to do that. But, like, for high school coaches listening, I'm a huge believer in depth chart transparency and in scout team viability. And it's not just, like, the quality of your scout team. Like, you guys wrote a great article on the Johnson kid from Duke, who I now coach his sister here at Stanford, and I love that family. So to give him a shout out, like, to pound pavement as the guy covering Brennan O'Neill on the scout team, and to actually be elevated from that role to now being like the cover one of an ACC blue blood. Like, that is everything I love about sports. And I hope that everyone realizes that that dream is real. It's not just like a fictionary thing that coaches make up.
The last remaining meritocracy. Let's talk about this game, because I, you know, you were commenting during the game about Charlie Caves, the job that he did guarding CJ Kearse, who I believe finished with 3 goals and an assist. The final, I want to say, was 11-8. Am I making that up?
I think that's right, yep.
And
15-9, actually, I think, but yeah.
Samsonite, way off. But it was a close game. It was 9-9. Yeah, it was. It was 9-9, and then Cornell separated late. And I just came away very impressed by Brown's defensive execution, particularly just how disruptive they were with their sticks, not in a way where they were flailing, but in a way in which their bodies were in good position. And they managed to get stick on stick consistently. It disrupted shots that ended up going on Cage, but ultimately were easier for Connor Foley to handle. And it disrupted passes that ultimately ended up going out of bounds. And I thought that those were the reasons in which they continuously gave their offense opportunities. You know, I don't have as much to say about the offensive execution. I wasn't as dialed in terms of paying attention at that end of the field. I do think that, to your point about, does Cornell have a championship level defense? I mean, I believe we talked about this last week. I know that I, you know, made the point somewhere. I produced too much content over the course of the last 2 months, but whatever. Like, you know, Cornell is a borderline top 20 defense. I believe that if you're a top 5 offense, top 5 faceoff unit, that's as good as you need to be defensively. Now, obviously, and on any given day basis, that might end up being true. But that being said, you know, I think you saw a little bit. There is no, you know, kind of number one lockdown guy on this group, right? The roles that Jason Singer and Dooley are kind of put into are specific to their skill set. And so could they get torched by a Sam King, you know, to the tune of 9 points, and that ends up being the reason that they lose in May? Yes, I think that they are susceptible to that. But I think, you know, they've gotten enough lift from Wyatt Nuss so far this season relative to the goalie performance that they got last year. They are protected by Jack Cascadon. And ultimately, if they get into a shootout, you're going to like their odds when the ball's in their stick. So acknowledging your concern, think it's totally valid. Think it is the reason that they are not a bona fide championship like favorite, but think that their defense is good enough to the point, and couple that with the fact that I don't think there is a championship favorite right now, wrapped up into the point where I think the defense is good enough that they deserve to be a bona fide championship contender, which is the highest tier at the moment.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I think we've flipped on this a little bit. If you remember early in the season, you were higher in Cornell than I was. I feel like I'm higher in Cornell now than you are.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Like, ultimately, so I pay more attention to Cornell. Like, my partner was the captain of the Cornell women's lacrosse team. So I, unlike in the past, like I do when I pull up the box score, like I'm semi-engaged every Saturday on like what is happening with Cornell. So I feel like I can speak to this. Like, ultimately, I think what a Cornell fan would argue is that against Brown, the complementary pieces to Kearse on the offensive side of the ball, like, had a B-minus, C-plus game, right? Like Firth, Kelleher, Long, like Goldstein, they all played below their standard. We do want to give credit to Torp and the Brown polls, which you articulated well, and I can go long form to comment on Brown's trendingness, but just to highlight specifically Kearse, like, ultimately, what we did here was we really created like a roadmap or a film that teams will use in May for how to guard him. 3 of those 4 points, just to be clear, came when Cave was either in transition or basically sliding. Like, ultimately, in the one-on-one true elbow matchup, he was held to 1-0. Which is like a great recipe for success in May against Cornell, obviously. And there are, I think Charlie Cave's very good. I think there's whatever, 10, 15, 20 polls who could argue are just as good, just as athletic, just as disruptive. So, like, what Cornell needs if they're going to be dominant and win 2 games in 1 weekend against 2 really high-end opponents is probably 15-plus goals in both games. Like, I do not think Cornell has a good enough netminder, clamper, or poles in short 6D mids to, like, win 10-8 on Memorial Day. I really don't. So because of that, like, I think there's going to be a ton of burden felt by Connor Busick and that staff to put Hugh Kelleher, Mikey Long, Goldstein in razor, you know, high wing matchups. That'll basically, like, alleviates the burden of Kirst having to initiate on the low wing everything, right? And to do it in a way where the defense is front side heavy. Like, you need, if you're Cornell, and by the way, they do this very well. They're you know, 10, 11, and 1. I'm not trying to at all claim that they're struggling. They're the number one team in the land. But for them to get it done and to dogpile, I think that's what you want to be focused on. So if you're a Cornell fan, you know, going to watch this weekend or whatever it may be, really focus on those high alley matchups. Are they generating leverage and making great decisions with the ball? Because you've got to get the ball spinning in space. It's kind of what we touched on earlier with QSND, and just kind of alleviating that weight. Because I actually think one of the best parts of our sport is it, unlike college basketball, right? Like, recruiting the five-star generational talent is what wins you basketball championships. That does not like unequivocally translate to a dog pile in May in lacrosse. Like, you need more than just CJ Kirst. And you know, me as an Ivy fan, and obviously I now have like a personal relationship with Cornell. Like, I want them. I'm pulling for them. So we'll see if they can get it done. But just to comment on Brown really quickly, and I want these kids to hear this from me. Like, I think the most frustrating part of this coaching change, the film last year and this year, is that I, like Larkin, the human and the eye test, have felt that Brown is better than some of the specific moments that we put out on film, whether it be last year where we struggled at a conference, or like this year, if you go watch the BU film, or you watch Villanova, or you watch the, you know, the first half against Penn. Like, what I saw against Cornell, and there's no moral victories in sports, and like, my expectation is to win every Ivy League game. So like, I am in no way trying to pat anyone on the back here. That quality though of like compete level decision making and polish is like what we all want and like hope that they believe in that room. And like, if they can go do that at home against Cornell, there's no reason they can't clip a few Ivy League games here and feel some success in the league as they trend towards year two under Torp. And like, you're never as far away as it feels. And Charlie Cave, Aiden, Foley, Wertheim, there are some very good lacrosse players in that room. And like, the alums know that, and we believe in you. And like, let's just go upset Princeton. Like, it's really not that hard. We did it last year when we were like 1-9. Like, it's not unheard of. So, great day for lacrosse in Providence, and congrats. The 1985 Ivy League champions were home, 40-year anniversary. So I hope those guys had a lot of fun on College Hill.
I can't imagine they didn't.
Yeah, no doubt.
Last game we're going to go deep on, and then we can hit some quickly, but the North Carolina Tar Heels welcomed the Virginia Cavaliers to town and walked out with an 18-9 victory. This game was 7-7 with, let's call it a third of the way in before the Tar Heels got two from Don Patrimala and one from Ryan Levy. Big day for the Levy family on Dorrance Field on Saturday, as Jenny's team came away with a victory over previous number one Boston College, and now will be the number one team in the Inside Lacrosse Kane media poll on Monday morning. But ultimately, it was all Tar Heels in the second half as, they put the clamps down, only allowing two goals to the Cavaliers en route to, like I said, an 18-9 victory, scoring the last six goals of the game. I mean, this was a bounce-back win as they come, and certainly that was the theme that Joe Bresci really kind of isolated coming away from this one. I felt like they got really good diversity and variability in scoring with 5 points each from Owen Duffy and Spencer Wertheim, and then four goals from Petromala, and like I said, three from Ryan Levy. So, you know, all in all, just a thorough kind of outplaying, and a particularly important one for a series that has now kind of flip-flopped between, I think there was like a almost 10 game stretch in the early 2000s. I want to say like the Sankey Bitter Holman era, where Carolina certainly had Virginia's number. That then flipped. I think Virginia had won 9-10 against the Tar Heels, and ultimately the history did not hold up in this one. Larkin, what'd you see?
I mean, it was a butt kick, and I will say, just as a fan, like, this was fantastic lacrosse. Also, something about the nets on Dorrance, like, every shot feels like it's just click and pipe. It's loud nets. Like, it's showtime. It feels like you're, you know, at Madison Square Garden playing basketball, to use a you know, a sports metaphor.
I want to build on that comment. So, blue helmets, white uniforms out of Carolina, beautiful. when I turned on the game, I don't remember which one I was paying attention more closely to, such that I started this one in the middle of the first quarter or something along those lines. As soon as I turned it on, I went white helmet, navy jersey with white numbers, orange shorts. Like, Virginia lost coming out of the locker room. That is not a combo that plays ever. You can go orange helmets if you want to do that. Quinn actually said it on the broadcast. I was surprised because he and I rarely agree on these fashion tweets or takes. But, oh my God. Like, the white helmets can be cool. You just have to wear them with white shorts, in which case you are not Virginia, which is fine. Be not Virginia once if you need to. You got to go orange helmets if you're going blue jerseys and orange shorts.
Yeah, and the stats don't ultimately show this because I think the face-off, the margin at the dot basically ended up being overwhelming. But through, let's call it, like 5 minutes into the second quarter, this was actually a close game where I thought UVA was, like, really, and Kevin Cassis' group, to his credit, was, like, showing some both developmental trending and also just, like, some pop. Like, ultimately, like, I thought McCabe had a few flashes. Some of their downhill midfielders showed burst, and like there were some great goals on both sides. So I was just like excited as a fan to engage in this game. And
yeah, it was punch for punch. It felt like a ACC heavyweight.
Totally, it felt like a heavyweight bout. It did not feel like a UVA team at 5-6 or whatever it was that had like quit on the season, which I loved. And as we all know, this is still Virginia. This is not a team you want in terms of like needing to beat for RPI implications. So because of all that, I actually think the story here is less about like Virginia and their unfortunate decline for this season, because I want to give them credit of their floor. Like, I really want to hammer home that this is still a team with, they're very well coached, and like they ultimately have good lacrosse players in that room and highly athletic. So I do believe that Joe Bresci and his group have taken steps, and they've answered some questions around, and this is the classic, obviously, this is our job as media members, is to like write this narrative, right? When we anointed UNC this March, right, it was because they went to Homewood and beat a team that was 4-0. Since then, the Jays, Penn, right, they've been trending in a different direction. So I think the UNC really need to make a statement, both with respect to, like, from an RPI perspective, they didn't want to lose it, but also I think to the regional advisory committee of, like, their quality, right?
Yeah.
And to the coaches poll and to, like, you, Terry, and me, Larkin, like, there were some murmurs going with respect to like what's going to happen down the stretch here with the Heels, and I thought they represented a lot of like what a true high end Carolina team is, which is often I need to like double check the roster for who is this kid. He's got like great lateral shake. He's banging offhand like high to high. I did think Nunes really struggled in net for the Hoos. He was guessing, and because of that, I don't want to like over comment on the quality of the UNC shooting, but it wasn't just Duffy and Petro. Like, they really were coming in waves and making plays all over the field. And John Thompson, who's a Brown alum, has that group spinning. I love what I see. And I think Carolina's dangerous. I really do, which is exciting.
Yeah. So I don't know if these are the guys that you're referring to, but to me, Carolina's ceiling is defined offensively by Caden Harshbarger and Mason Suchuk, a pair of freshman midfielders who just bring pop athletically that is crazy to say because it's Carolina. Like, I don't think exists elsewhere on the roster. And, you know, one guy's at 6 goals, 5 assists. One guy's at 6 goals, 3 assists. You hear about the freshman wall. Are they going to hit it? Or are they going to be the guys that actually end up, you know, kind of, I don't know, like busting through and showing that, you know, they're not going to be limited by that. And there are other guys, right? Andrew Price is certainly one that's been a first-line midfielder, I believe, you know, at points this season. Parker Hoffman is the backup faceoff guy who takes the wings and, you know, ended up throwing an absolute dime cross-field assist in this one yesterday. So there are other guys that they can rely on. But I think those are the two with the athletic pedigree, right? This is not me responding to it on the basis of their recruiting rankings. It's on the basis of, you know, what we've seen them do in the prior level and seeing whether or not it can translate. Because if they get those guys, in addition to what they've been getting out of Madden and English and Wertheim and now Levy, now all of a sudden you have a top nine where preparing for them becomes way more variable and way more difficult. And I think that that's the difference between a team that could be upset in the first round, certainly, and then more likely is also an underdog in the quarterfinals versus a team that has a bona fide shot at the Final Four. And I think that that's exactly where Carolina sits right now. You know, when we talked about the firmness of the top four coming away from the first bracketology exercise, they were in that group. I don't know that the numbers are going to keep them there. And I think that they're going to have to continue to win in order to make sure that they can bolster that position. You know, because if they lose to Notre Dame, they won't be there. And they've got trips to Duke and Syracuse sandwiched around. So, you know, there's a lot left for the Heels to write in terms of this season. But there's no doubt that, you know, on the basis of the way that last year went, and certainly 2 years ago, you got to be pleased with the progress if you're Bubba Cunningham or an alum who's looking to make sure that you're maintaining the status quo.
It would be very on brand for Bresci, I think, to not only like return to the tournament, but to kind of like really punch through that ceiling and potentially go on a run. And kind of, I think that's candidly part of the frustration in the narrative is like you almost want more kind of traditional consistency of like quarters every year and whatever it may be. But yeah, I really like this group. And to Terry's point on the RPI placement, like they are now in a position where if they clip Duke, which they should at Duke, right, even if they go one out of the two with Notre Dame and Cuse, like, they realistically are going to have a fairly straightforward first-round matchup, or should, right? They're going to be a top-four seed. If that exact thing plays out, in my opinion, they'll be a top-four seed. And then you end up with, like, the winner of the A-10 or the CAA or whatever it may be. And, you know, is that, like, a layup? Of course not. But that's certainly a lot easier than Sam King and Harvard coming to town. And, you know, you obviously we'll see where it fleshes out with respect to the quarters. But Final Four watch is on. And for the Carolina faithful who have been waiting to get back to Gillette and Memorial Day, how exciting is that? And just fun to watch. Fun group to watch. Swaggy group. I mean, every time Dom strokes it, it's like, wow, that looks like it's going in, which is cool.
So let's, like I said, let's. I've got five quick ones, and I'll just throw them all out there, and you can react however you want. Aiden Carroll gives Georgetown an overtime victory at Marquette, avoids what would have been, I don't want to call it a disastrous loss, but certainly a very meaningful loss with respect to the Big East standings. A week after UMass beats St. Joe's to kind of separate themselves alongside Richmond as the two top teams in the Atlantic 10, John Crowley gets his first ranked win as a head coach with High Point upsetting the Minutemen. Loyola gets their first win of the season by virtue of a overtime game-winning goal that included a Max Watkinson overtime save to set up, I believe, Brady West with the game winner. Duke took care of business in Boston against the Terriers, which, you know, given kind of how things had shaped up with respect to BU's win over Army, is of significance, certainly, as Duke ends their two-game losing streak. And then Army takes care of business against Colgate, Navy takes care of business against Lafayette, and that sets up an Army-Navy game in which both teams will be coming in off of wins. Larkin, which of those struck your ear?
I think multiple did. I think it gets at this umbrella narrative of like the mid-major, to use a basketball term, it's not fair to those conferences, but the non-ACC Big Ten Ivy conference tournaments, which we've hammered all year, are going to be so compelling, right?
When you just think to about, be... Like, so that you don't have to apologize every time you use the term mid-major, like, so if there's 10 conferences, so basically there are three that are high major, there are three that are mid-major, right. And there are three that are low, right? Like, that's just kind of...
It feels more derogatory in college basketball, but you're right. In college lacrosse, it really shouldn't be. Like, I really do love the idea, and I might personally, like, try and fly and go to one of these, where the Big East tournament, like, I think a lot of people expected Georgetown to get on that plane to Milwaukee and win that game. I don't know, 13-8 maybe, where Marquette doesn't really test them, right? And so not only do we have a indecision with respect to the actual champion of those tournaments, we now have like a 4 seed or a 5 seed introducing themselves into the mix where the A-10, everyone, just to use a hyper-specific example, everyone's been focused on this debate between Richmond and St. Joe's and UMass, and now you have like a late-trending High Point or whatever it may be. So I just think you have some really interesting matchups and developments down the mid-major slate, let's call it, with respect to regular season. And two more things. One, the Colgate explosion. I think we've had an unfortunate reversion to the mean, and that will impact Harvard's RPI over time if their winning percentage continues to decrease. I think they've lost 3 of their last 4. And really happy for the human beings in that locker room at Loyola. Like, there's a ton of expectation when you play lacrosse at Loyola. They won a national championship, like, fairly recently. They're perennial NCAA tournament contenders with respect to winning the Patriot League automatic qualifier. like, as a human, as an 18 to 22 year old, it's just a, it's a large, like, burden to bear when you lose every week and you feel like you're, like, letting down someone that you look up to, someone that gave you your college opportunity, someone who's paying for you to go to college, etc. So I'm just, like, really happy for the guys. I hope they loaded up some kegs on a pickup truck, and I hope they had a ton of fun. And, like, this is sports. It's supposed to be fun. Great overtime winner. Great Selly. Like, I'm sure the bus, for the first time in 2 months, had some pop, and really, really happy for those guys and their families. So I love stuff like that.
Well said. The human element. Not to be forgotten. But to your earlier point, May 1st. May 1st is the Thursday of quarterfinal weekend action. If you're on the East Coast, take a half day. If you're a student, make sure you schedule a doctor's appointment for like noon so you can take the rest of the day off after school. It's one of the best hidden gems on the lacrosse calendar. Larkin, if you decide to make a trip, then let me know. Maybe we can do a live podcast. Who knows? But in the meantime, this has been the Tailgate Podcast. Thank you for listening. We will read out our friends at the NCAA since we didn't hit the whole thing up top. The Men's and Women's Lacrosse Championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to the 26th, there is nowhere else in the lacrosse world to be other than Foxborough, Massachusetts for 8 of the best and most impactful games of the season. This year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off all single-day ticket options, men and women, by using code ILPOD at checkout. Head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase. You know you're going to be there. Why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome we are by purchasing your tickets today? Once again, ncaa.com/laxtickets and ILPOD at checkout for $5 off. Larkin, thank you so much. This was awesome. Can't wait to talk again next week. We got another great slate in store.
Good work. Back to week. Never have a productive week.